a genocide not forgotten today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Under ousted President Omar al-Bashir, the Sudanese government was responsible for atrocities in Darfur. The consequences are still felt today.
For the people of Darfur, it was and continues to be totally devastating. Communities were destroyed, and many have to this day not been able to return to their land.
But will Bashir be held accountable? Also, at Mexico's southern border with Guatemala, migrants continue to cross on their way to the U.S. Plus, Switzerland decides coffee is not vital to human survival, although plenty of Swiss would disagree.
Well, it's really sad because it has emotional, it's binding the people together. That's why we feel that we want to have coffee always.
All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you here today. Momentous times across North Africa this past week. For the first time in years, civilians are feeling hope in Sudan and Algeria after they helped to oust dictators who'd been in power for decades. Though big questions remain about what happens next in both countries. First to Sudan. President Omar al-Bashir is gone, and we learned today that Bashir's defense minister, who took the helm as the leader of the transitional government in Sudan, he's also stepping down. Other military associates in the former government of Bashir remain in power, though, and they say they will not allow Omar al-Bashir to be extradited to The Hague. The Hague is home to the ICC, the International Criminal Court, where Bashir faces charges of crimes against humanity. Rebecca Hamilton used to work for the ICC and now teaches law at American University in Washington. Thanks for being back, Beck. What charges does Bashir face in The Hague exactly, and what do they relate to?
He faces very serious charges of genocide, of war crimes, and of crimes against humanity for atrocities committed by the Sudanese government and their proxy militia force, which we know as the Janjaweed, in Darfur starting in 2003. The genocide charges in particular say that President Bashir is responsible for overseeing the apparatus of the state that was designed to destroy at least three particular ethnic groups within Darfur, the Four, the Zagawa, and the Masalit people. And it did this by killing them, by causing serious physical and mental harm, including mass rapes, and by inflicting conditions of life that were calculated to destroy the groups. And there was horrific testimony regarding children, infants even, being thrown into fires, the mass rapes of women, torture, and just a litany of destruction.
Yeah, I'm taken back to those horrific times. I mean, you worked and lived in Sudan in those years as a journalist. Do you have one person or family that you know that suffered under Bashir and that made a particular impression on you?
Gosh, so many. I think one that I will never be able to forget was interviewing a woman in a camp who she had just made it across the border into Chad, and she had her young baby in her arms, and she had recently given birth. She had other children that were running around, and just this overwhelming sense of having no idea what the future would look like. She was sort of glad, I guess, grateful that her children had survived when for so many of her neighbors, that was not the case. But even having survived that, there was a sense of total loss with respect to what the future would look like.
Yeah, so the world shouldn't hold its breath for extradition. Where do the cases against Bashir and his co-defendants actually stand in The Hague?
The ICC arrest warrants are still outstanding, and until some state actually executes the arrest warrant and Bashir goes to The Hague, then we're not going to see a trial. Now, while we're focused on the arrest warrant by the ICC for the crimes in Darfur, I think it's also worth pointing out that this is the same man, Omar al-Bashir, who presided over the second Sudanese civil war in South Sudan that led to the deaths of some 2 million people. So while the ICC is only looking at crimes committed in Darfur, his responsibility for atrocities within Sudan extends beyond Darfur into what is now South Sudan, into the Nuba Mountains and other areas.
Rebecca Hamilton, formerly with the International Criminal Court, now at American University in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The ousters this month of Omar al-Bashir in Sudan and Abdelaziz Bouteflika in Algeria, they've got some similarities. Both men lost power after massive street protests reminiscent of the Arab Spring of 2011. The change of power raises hopes of serious reform in both countries, and that prospect is reverberating across the region. Magdi Abdelhadi is an independent Middle East analyst. He's based in London. Let's turn first to Sudan, Magdi. We just heard how the country is now in the hands of strongmen, cut really from the same cloth as the ousted Omar al-Bashir. What do you think of the prospects for real change?
Well, I think it's a very difficult question to answer because the people, the protesters on the streets have categorically rejected what the military have offered, the 2 years transitional period. And they seem to have learned from earlier protests in neighboring Egypt, where there are very, very many parallels with what happened there in 2011. The military stepped in and told the people, we're going to look after the country, we'll organize elections, and look where Egypt is now. And I think the Sudanese protesters have been very aware of that. Some of the slogans actually were to the effect that we do not want a repeat of Egypt. And very similar slogans were raised in Algiers, where also the protesters there managed to bring to, so far, a peaceful end, the reign of former President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. The short answer is no one really knows for sure what will happen next.
As I said, Magdi, Sudan and Algeria's neighbors are closely watching what's been going on with these historic changes at the top of the leadership. You're just back from Cairo. What's the reaction you saw there in Egypt?
The Egyptians, of course, are following very closely what has been going on in Sudan and in Algiers, and they're painfully reminded of the euphoria that they, too, once experienced in 2011, when after 18 days of protests in central Cairo and Tahrir Square, they toppled Mubarak. But sadly, they realized that they only toppled the head of the regime, and the regime itself has remained intact and is reestablished an authoritarian order far much worse than what preceded it. Some of them, despite their failure, have been volunteering advice to the Algerians and to the Sudanese. One group says, do not make our mistake. Do not leave the streets until you completely dismantle the regime. Others are of a different opinion. The advice they forward to the Sudanese and to the Algerians is try to reach a compromise with the old regime, because demanding the fulfillment of all your demands, you may end up with nothing being fulfilled at all.
How anxious do you think President Sisi of Egypt is?
Extremely anxious for various reasons. Egypt shares a border with Sudan, and chaos in Sudan would undermine stability, will be a nightmare for the Egyptian military to control the border. But also, if Sudan were to develop towards a more open form of government, the Egyptians will eventually say, hey, if the Sudanese can have this, why can't we? He's also extremely concerned about the unfolding conflict in Libya. There is a war going on in Libya, and it's a war between a Libyan army general whom the Egyptians are firmly behind, hoping that he will be able to dislodge Islamist militias in the West. And if he fails, it means that Libya too is a big menace for stability in Egypt. And if the Algerians manage a transition to a democratic form of government, the Egyptians will also say, if Algerians can have this, why can't we? So I bet he is extremely nervous.
It is a lot of real estate. Algeria, Libya, Egypt, and Sudan. Wow. Magdi Abdelhadi, Middle East analyst. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's something surprising. While Sudan was in turmoil this week, South Sudan was trying something new to overcome its own recent turmoil. South Sudan, the world's youngest nation, you'll remember, gained its independence from Sudan in 2011. Since then, it's been tangled up in a brutal civil war that's left hundreds of thousands of people dead. At the heart of the conflict, a bitter rivalry between two leaders. This week, though, those two leaders were invited to a spiritual retreat at the Vatican by Pope Francis. My BBC colleague Martin Bashir was there to witness it.
South Sudan's president, Salva Kiir, a Catholic, was the first to land and made a courtesy visit to the offices of the Italian Prime Minister. accompanied by his own military general and clad in his favourite 10-gallon Stetson hat, Keir moved quickly through a ceremonial guard. Four vice presidents, all professing Christians, who've agreed to make up a transitional government, soon arrived at Santa Marta, the guesthouse within the Vatican. The idea of a spiritual retreat was proposed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, and endorsed by the Vatican in the hope that it might encourage the political leadership of South Sudan to reconcile for the sake of the youngest country in the world. Archbishop Justin Welby, speaking to us inside the Vatican, said the gathering had been a challenge for all sides.
Did any of the parties express regret, repentance?
There is a deep sense of sorrow from everyone. Of sorrow at what the South Sudan has become. And a deep sense that they must take responsibility for confronting what has happened.
If persuading avowed enemies to meet together wasn't significant enough, the retreat concluded with one of the most dramatic actions of the Francis pontificate. First, he stepped in front of the desk where he delivered prepared remarks and made an unscripted appeal to seek the common good.
Rimanete nella pace.
Stay in peace.
Lo chiedo col cuore.
I'm asking you with my heart.
Ci saranno lotte fra voi, voi due.
There will be struggles, disagreements amongst
sì.
You.
Davanti al popolo.
But in front of the people,
le mani unite.
Hold hands united.
Then, walking towards them, the 82-year-old pontiff knelt and kissed the feet of the President Salva Kiir, Vice President Riek Machar, and Government Minister Rebecca Gurang.
It has touched me deeply because these things have never happened in the world and in the history of these three denominations coming together for one country.
What was your reaction when Pope Francis bent down? Because you started to cry.
Tears was running down my face because I could not imagine what we have done, the destruction we have done. And somebody like him is very concerned about our people. So it's something which is touching, which people of South Sudan will see.
Do you feel now that the opportunity for peace is real? Do you feel that as leaders you can go back and establish this unity government next month?
Me as an individual have seen the light at the end of the tunnel. And the future of South Sudan have never been brighter than now. And I have to speak for myself. And I have made decision that no matter what happened, I have to stand on the side of my people.
The final act involved the presentation of a Bible signed by the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury with this message: seek that which unites, overcome that which divides.
The BBC's Martin Bashir reporting there from the Vatican. Just ahead, when Airbnb listed homes for rent in the West Bank, it stepped into a major controversy.
You know, they're built on land unlawfully seized, and they contribute to a system of discrimination.
And that tension didn't go away when Airbnb tried to delist West Bank homes.
It's not for American companies to determine if the territories are occupied or not.
Airbnb and the politics of vacation rentals, that's just ahead. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Maybe you spotted this last November. Airbnb caused a big stir when it said it was going to stop listing homes for rent in the West Bank. That announcement immediately sparked a lawsuit by people who rent their homes on Airbnb. They claimed the policy was discriminatory. Nitzana Leitner is the lawyer who represented a dozen American Jewish families in that lawsuit against Airbnb. She says the company only delisted houses that belonged to people of one religious group.
They did not delist Muslims or Christians or Palestinians that rent their houses and list their houses on Airbnb's site, but only the Jewish one. And it's prohibited according to the Fair Housing Law. This law prohibits discrimination based on nationality, religion, gender. This one is based on religion, just because they were Jewish, and it's it's unlawful.
Airbnb has since reversed its announcement, but the debates continue. Some ask, what does it mean politically when Airbnb lists homes in a disputed territory? Omar Shakir leads Human Rights Watch in Israel and the Palestinian territories. He says just by listing the homes in the West Bank, Airbnb is getting tangled in underlying issues of discrimination there.
Settlements are the only example in the entire world Human Rights Watch can find in which an Airbnb host must discriminate by national or ethnic origin. Palestinians cannot enter except as laborers bearing special permits. So even if the host wanted to have a Palestinian stay in a listing on their website, it could be a Palestinian American, for example, that has a U.S. citizenship but a Palestinian citizenship, they could not rent to that Palestinian under Israeli military law. So it's a case in which discrimination is baked into the law.
Now let's hear a bit more in-depth from both sides. We asked Nitzana Leitner, the lawyer for the Jewish families who sued Airbnb, if that kind of discrimination against Palestinians came up in her client's case.
Not yet. Airbnb filed a motion to dismiss and asked us to settle the case. They wanted to find a way to end this case, to cancel their policy without getting into the issue whether the territories are occupied, whether the settlements are legal.
I mean, Airbnb, it should be said, never actually ended up taking the listings offline. So was this kind of a preemptive settlement?
It was an injunction that we filed. And plus a lawsuit for damages if they occurred in the course of this litigation, if Airbnb would decide to delist the specific plaintiffs that filed this lawsuit.
I'm curious, too, about the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. This feels like kind of part and parcel of that. How much did BDS bump into this lawsuit?
Oh, a lot. The Human Rights Watch organization and other BDS organizations put tremendous pressure on Airbnb to delist the Jewish homes. After this agreement was announced, the Human Rights Watch organization came and condemned Airbnb for taking this weak act, as they called it. But they have to understand that boycotting Israel is illegal in the United States. Any American company that will collapse the pressure of the BDS movement and will boycott Israel will be sued. You can't say that Muslims are not welcome in your territory. You cannot say that Jews are not welcome either.
Right. So you recognize the discrimination against Palestinians. Is the pressure then understandable from your opposing parties? You brought this lawsuit to the Human Rights Watch as well. You understand the pressure that they're bringing.
I can't accept this. I can't agree with it. It's not for American companies or American universities or anyone in the world to determine if the territories are occupied or not, if the Palestinians' rights are violated lawfully or unlawfully. They have never stepped foot in a settlement or in an Arab village. So it's very easy to stay outside in Europe, in the United States, and scream BDS, BDS, or Israeli apartheid state, without really knowing what's going on. And if you want to help the Palestinians' rights, you can go, you can help, you can be involved without violating the law.
Attorney Nitzana Leitner, the president of the Sirat Hadin Israel Law Center, thank you for your time.
I appreciate it, Marco. Thank you for having me.
On the other hand, Omar Shakir from Human Rights Watch says not to draw too much of a conclusion from Airbnb settling the case against it. He frames the entire controversy this way.
There was no ruling in this case. This was a case in which a settlement was reached. There was no finding that there was wrongdoing committed. The parties agreed to a settlement. In essence, Airbnb was bullied into not following through with its own policy. You know, they're built on land unlawfully seized, and they contribute to a system of discrimination. So the basis, the underlying discrimination here has to do with Israeli policy towards Palestinians and not the fact that Airbnb chose not initially, before retracting, to be complicit in that abuse.
Leitner also suggested that this delisting policy was going to be enacted by people who have never been to the region, so they don't even have a concept of how people like Palestinians are being discriminated against there. How do you respond to that? Is that a fair argument?
Look, I mean, the reality here, these issues are quite clear. The UN guiding principle on business and human rights is quite clear. A business cannot contribute to and benefit from serious rights abuses. Airbnb engaged in a lengthy process. We spent 2 years engaging them of studying these issues, understanding what's happening. Information is readily available. There are reports, there are information from a multitude of sources. There are UN resolutions that are out there. And they reached a decision in November to, you know, delist in settlements. And I think the important thing to understand from the decision that was made as a result of the settlement, that, you know, they still have a policy around doing business in occupied territories and still find settlements to be afoul of their policy, including because they contribute to existing suffering. They have not disclaimed that position. All they've said is that they're not going to follow their own factual determination to its logical conclusion, which is to delist instead donating profits, essentially because they were bullied into it.
Before the settlement, though, this all had been seen as a victory for the BDS movement. But Airbnb now is actually stating that it's distancing itself from the BDS movement. Do you see that as a setback?
This was not at all about a political movement. This is about a company's direct actions, and any attempt to make it about BDS misconstrues the underlying dynamics of an issue that's about corporations and their human rights responsibilities under international law.
So, Omar, is Airbnb breaking international law again, and do you see more lawsuits coming down the line?
Airbnb is continuing to do business in settlements. That's in not only in violation of the UN guiding principles, which is, you know, the responsibilities that businesses have across the world, but also in violation of its own policies, including an anti-discrimination policy that seeks to prevent the kind of situation in which a person can't stay in an Airbnb listing solely because of who they are, which is exactly what's now taking place with West Bank settlements.
Omar Shakir, the Israel and Palestine Director for Human Rights Watch, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
The World reached out to Airbnb to discuss the issue of listing homes for rent in West Bank settlements. They referred us to a lengthy statement on their new policy, which says in part that Airbnb will not remove the listings, but they will not take any profits from them either. The policy might be applied to Airbnb rentals in other disputed territories around the globe. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. Every day, migrants cross from Guatemala into Mexico on their way north to the U.S., and not all of them are from Central America.
I've spoken to people who come from Congo, from Angola, from Bangladesh, certainly many of them from Honduras, but also from Cuba and from places that are much, much farther away.
An update from southern Mexico that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We've been following the dramatic stories of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, people who've escaped harm and traveled often on foot over long distances trying to get to the United States. At Mexico's southern border, a parallel situation is playing out. Migrants from Latin America and around the world are crossing north from Guatemala into Mexico, and they're also running into serious roadblocks that are stopping them in their tracks. Reporter Jorge Valencia with member station KJZZ joins us from Chiapas, Mexico, just north of the Guatemalan border. Describe the scene where you are, Jorge.
Hey, Marco. I am outside of an immigration office here in Chiapas, about an hour north of the border. I'm looking at tents, at dozens and dozens of people, women, children, a bunch of guys. And they have been here for, people who tell me they've been here for weeks. At this place in particular where I am right now, I've spoken to people who come from Congo, from Angola, from Bangladesh. But there are also other makeshift camps that are in around the city. We're talking like thousands of people, certainly many of them from Honduras, as we've seen for quite some time, but also from Cuba and from places that are much, much farther away.
Yeah, is that surprising? I mean, that's a really vast and varied number of countries.
what had been happening with these, what we call nowadays caravans that we started seeing a few months ago, is that they would enter Mexico and they would, for the most part, legally be allowed to cross into Mexico to reach the U.S. And what's new here is that they are being stopped here. Immigration officials here are saying that they are overwhelmed and they can't process their applications quickly enough for humanitarian visas. And so that is how we're getting these massive, massive crowds spread in multiple places here in the southern part of Mexico.
Yeah, so lawfully crossing Mexico, destination USA?
Yes, everybody that I've spoken to, that's what they said that they want to go to.
Among the migrants, you said, are people who fled from Cuba. What's their situation?
Yeah, so I have met many people who are here from Cuba. It is very difficult to give a number of how many people, but at the very least in the hundreds. Some have been here for weeks. Some say they've been here for a couple of months. And so they're growing increasingly frustrated because they say that they just want to lawfully cross Mexico. And Mexico is not telling them either yes or no. Yesterday, I was at a rally of Cuban migrants. There is an activist. He is Mexican. His name is Luis Villagran. I just want to play you a little bit of what that rally was like.
Vamos a demostrarles al mundo que podemos ordenadamente migrar.
¡Sí!
¡Paso libre!
¡Libertad!
¡Libertad! ¡Libertad! ¡Libertad!
So Villagran is encouraging them to find the means to get on buses and go all the way to Mexico City to have their applications processed there. And what you hear in return is this crowd. People are quite upset, making a cry out for freedom.
Yeah, libertad, libertad. How did they get from Cuba to southern Mexico?
I have spoken to several people asking them the same question. One man, his name is Ariel Guerra. He's 33 years old. He told me he flew to Guyana because that was the only country where he could go to without a visa. And then he traveled by land to Brazil, Peru, Ecuador, through Colombia, and then from there through Central America to get here.
Yo lo que veo es un potrero con animales dentro. Nosotros no somos seres humanos, me parece. Yo creo que estas no son ni condiciones, porque estos ni en los animales, porque los animales los tratan mejor que nosotros.
Guerra is describing the place where he's staying at as a pigsty. And just to illustrate it a little bit for you, it is quite literally a soccer field where Guerra and a few hundred others are sleeping out in the open air, many of them just literally sleeping on the grass, sometimes getting water from government officials. But that's about it in terms of provisions while they wait for their applications to be processed.
And the Cubans, like pretty much everybody else you've met, they're also trying to reach the U.S. That's their final destination.
Yes, people here are quite desperate. There was somebody else that I met who's staying on that soccer field. She was 18 years old from Honduras. Her name is Giselle Fuentes. This is what she had to say about what she's willing to endure to get to the U.S.
Yo creo de que uno por llegar al por el sueño americano, allá lo que sea.
So you heard her say there, el sueño americano,
yep.
The American dream. She believes that she and everybody else that she's there with, that they're willing to endure whatever it takes to achieve the American dream, which at this point is merely reaching the U.S. border.
Right, which means at this point walking across the entire territory of Mexico. I mean, this is happening at the same time that President Trump is pressuring Mexico, as you know, to stop migrants from crossing the U.S. border. It may be hard to determine if the backup at the U.S.-Mexico border has had a knock-on effect at the Mexico-Guatemala border, but do you know if the situation you're seeing is connected in any way to the messages we're hearing from the White House?
We can't say with full certainty whether or not that is the case, but it is a remarkable coincidence that around the same time that President Trump started pressuring Mexico publicly via tweets to stop the flow of migrants, around that time, Mexican officials suddenly started saying that they were overwhelmed with applications and that they couldn't, and they stopped giving people humanitarian visas to continue crossing north. What I would add to that is that Mexico has long been processing these types of applications. They typically take a few days. And like I said, people have been here for close to a month now.
Reporter Jorge Valencia with member station KJZZ speaking with us from Chiapas, Mexico. Thanks very much, Jorge.
You're welcome, Marco.
Coffee lovers, I don't want you to kill the messenger, but coffee is not essential to human health, at least not in Switzerland. The Swiss government announced this week it will no longer include coffee in its national stockpile of emergency food supplies. Hans Hefliger is the director at Réserve Suisse. It's the company in Switzerland that manages the stockpile of foods and grains there, including, up till now, coffee. How do you feel, Hans, about the Swiss government's announcement that it will no longer stockpile emergency supplies of coffee?
The companies that are obliged to hold stocks were not so happy about the new idea of the government because they changed the logic. The new argument is now that they stock only calories, and it's clear coffee never had calories in it. So this is the main argument. It's one logic, but sometimes you need also some psychology elements to survive crises, I would say. You live not only from calories.
So you're saying coffee has kind of a psychological element that's crucial for the people of Switzerland?
Not only in Switzerland, I would say. It's more over the world.
Yeah, I got to say, I kind of agree. Where is this stockpile actually kept?
The idea is that the task is given to the economic actors. All coffee importers, coffee brewers, coffee companies were obliged to have some more stocks. It's in the workflow. 50% of the stocks held in Switzerland are mandatory stocks by the government. 50% are the private businesses.
What is the history of stockpiling coffee in Switzerland? Why does the country do it?
I guess, you know, Switzerland is a landlocked country and we have no sea access. So we are always dependent from the supply chain working. The base of the idea is experienced during the World War First and Second. We were completely kept out of supply chains. So this is the first idea of having some own stocks.
Hans Hefliger of Réserve Suisse explaining the Swiss government's decision to stop stockpiling coffee. That news, as you can imagine, is a bummer for some people.
Well, it's really sad because coffee has such a symbolic value for us, and it has been always this stockpiling of coffee because it has emotional, it has a social, it's binding the people together. That's why we feel that we want to have coffee always.
Chahan Yeretsian is a coffee scientist and the head of coffee excellency in Switzerland. The world's Lucy Martirosian met up with him at the Specialty Coffee Expo, where coffee professionals met up today here in Boston.
As you just heard, Yeretsian is really passionate about coffee. He's a self-described coffee geek. He's sad about the Swiss government's decision, but he also doesn't think it's so necessary to stockpile coffee nowadays.
Coffee production is really widespread. So if there's a crisis somewhere, we're going to find the supply from somewhere else. So there's no more risk that we'll run out of the supply of coffee today.
I know why coffee is important for me personally. I mean, I probably wouldn't have even made it to work without it. But is it really so important to the human experience? Yeretsian thinks so.
Starbucks have actually proven and demonstrated the importance of coffee as a tool, as something that brings people together. So it is an integrating factor. People meet around coffee, and coffee really brings people together. And having a mug in your hand, it's actually proven statistically also, makes you look nicer, you know, so you see in all these news channels people walking with a mug in their hand.
Yeah, I definitely look really good with my mug as a journalist. But what about the health impact? Switzerland says coffee has no nutritional value because it has no calories. Yeretsian says you have to think bigger than just caloric intake.
Caffeine is really more in the short term. It helps you to improve your mental and physical performance. So you cannot consider it as a health impact, but it helps you in the short term.
I'm sure you've seen this debate too. Researchers and scientists go back and forth on whether coffee is actually good for us.
At some point also science started to say coffee is bad for you, but that was actually based on what we call on confounding factors that were not well separated. There were a lot of smokers or people who did less workout was associated with coffee drinking. And so sometimes they discovered with coffee drinkers some negative health connotations, but that was not related to coffee.
Awesome. Yeretsian just gave me a thumbs up to keep drinking coffee. Speaking of which, he also told me what to look out for in a fresh espresso.
Well, first of all, there's the visual aspect. If you prepare espresso from a fresh coffee, you will have a very nice creamer. This foam, this creamer, is a demonstration of the presence of a lot of gas inside the coffee that is only present if your coffee is fresh.
For The World, I'm Lucy Martirosian in Boston.
And for the record, our coffee scientist there, Chahan Yuritsian, drinks about 6 to 10 cups of coffee a day. Lucy clocks in at 1 to 2 cups. Me, I'm going steady with 3 to 4 shots of espresso every morning, but I've yet to accessorize with a coffee mug. You may have heard about this news out of Hungary. The Hungarian State Opera is staging a problematic version of the American opera Porgy and Bess. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has some strong opinions about that.
Porgy and Bess, the Gershwin masterpiece, is a love story set in a fictional poor black neighborhood in the American South. In this song, Porgy declares his love for Bess, who's being shunned by the rest of the community.
Bess, you is my woman now. You is.
When the opera premiered in 1935, it was groundbreaking because it was written for and performed by an all-black cast. And in fact, the Gershwin estate requires that all performances of Porgy and Bess star all black singers. Now enter the Hungarian State Opera, which is reviving Porgy and Bess for a limited run this week. The opera's general director is a guy named Sylvester Okovach, an ally of Hungary's far-right, anti-immigrant Prime Minister Viktor Orbán. What could possibly go wrong? Well, for one, Okovach hired a white cast, and then to get around the casting stipulation, he asked the performers to sign an affidavit saying they self-identify as African-American, and more than half the cast signed.
It ain't necessarily so.
It ain't necessarily so.
The things that you liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily.
Okovach seems to be reveling in all the attention this stunt has brought him. In this interview, he's telling the Hungarian channel ATV that Hungary doesn't keep records of skin color, so he couldn't tell whether the cast is black or not. I can only assume he's being completely sarcastic. And then when a Hungarian website called Index basically asked him, "What were you thinking?" he submitted 22 questions of his own, among them, "Is Barack Obama black enough to perform in Porgy and Bess?" And "What shade of black do you have to be on the Pantone color scale to perform in Porgy and Bess?" To which I say, "What shade of jerk do you have to be the director of the Hungarian State Opera?" For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Ohio just adopted one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. It bans abortion once a fetal heartbeat can be detected. That's typically before many women even realize they're pregnant. It's part of a trend here in some states to make it harder for women to get an abortion. But in some other parts of the world, the trend is heading in the other direction. Yesterday, we mentioned that a South Korean court just lifted the ban on abortion there. And in Rwanda, where abortion is mostly illegal, the president just issued a pardon to hundreds of women in jail for abortion. The world's Allison Herrera has a story.
When Rwandan President Paul Kagame pardoned 367 women last week who were imprisoned for abortion, many women's advocates were surprised because it was the second time he did it. Chantal Umuhoza is with the rights group Spectra.
It's not very often that he pardons people for different crimes. So for this to happen twice, it really showed us as activists that there was something that was positive coming through.
Something positive coming, she says. Umuhoza met with some of the jailed women after their release, and she says several of them told her they were arrested after they sought medical help for a miscarriage.
They had bleeding, and then when they went for medical care, someone reported them that they had an abortion and they were taken to prison. So it was up to them to prove that they didn't actually have induced abortion. And if you can't prove that, then some of these women would end up to prison.
Rwanda used to have one of the most restrictive abortion laws in Africa. But in 2012, the government revised the law to allow abortion in cases of rape, incest, and danger to a woman's life. But even then, a woman seeking an abortion had to get a court approval. That changed last year, says Asia Russell, with the group Health Global Access Project.
And that's important because, as you can imagine, women were experiencing life-threatening consequences as a result of a pregnancy and having to wait for adjudication to agree with what she already knew. And in some cases, there were devastating health consequences as a result.
Advocates say they hope Kagame's pardons signal that the government may be moving towards making safe abortions more accessible to more women.
No human should ever be criminalized for the health services that they require. And abortion is ultimately health care.
But Rwanda is still a conservative country, says Chantal Umuhoza. She points out that even though more than 50% of the lawmakers are women, it doesn't mean that they support abortion rights. For The World, I'm Allison Herrera.
Earlier this week, we told you about Haitian immigrants living in the U.S. under temporary protected status. A quick update on that now. A judge in New York has said no to the Trump administration's plan to cancel TPS for Haitians. That could impact about 50,000 undocumented Haitians who currently live and work legally in the U.S. Many of them received TPS after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, which killed hundreds of thousands and created severe hardship for many people there. The Trump administration argues that conditions have improved enough to cancel TPS. Lawyers who sued the administration argued that the severe hardship continues in Haiti. They also cited derogatory comments President Trump has made about Haitians. In yesterday's ruling, Judge William Kuntz suggested that the White House policy was racially based. And he wrote, a TPS termination should not be a political decision made to carry out political motivations. The New York case is one of six lawsuits challenging the administration's termination of TPS programs for people from multiple countries. All big news stories have their own lexicon. The Trump presidency has MAGA, fake news, covfefe. Bill Clinton did a deep dive into what the meaning of the word is. Nixon's Watergate produced expletive deleted, and of course, scandals after that became this gate, that gate. Another big story with a rich lexicon is Brexit. The World's Patrick Cox is here. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Marco.
So do you think the word Brexit itself, does it even convey whatever it is Britain is going through right now?
Who knows? It's snappy, right? And it makes the whole process of leaving the European Union seem kind of simple.
Where did it come from initially?
Well, it was first used in 2012. It was coined by a guy called Peter Wilding. He works at a think tank. He borrowed it from another portmanteau word, Grexit. If you remember, Greek exit. It
right.
was talking about exiting the euro. And now they're both English words, and we really can't get rid of them.
So you've really been down the Brexit rabbit hole, Patrick.
And guess what, Marco? I'm going to invite you down there, too.
Here we go.
Quiz time.
So what's the nature of this quiz?
Well, I'm going to give you a few words and see if you can figure out what they mean.
Okay.
Okay.
They're Brexit related?
They're all Brexit related. A lot of portmanteau Brexit words like Brextremist, Brexitus, Brexternity. I'm not going to ask you about any of those. Here's a slightly different one along similar lines. Flextension.
Flextension. To be flexible in this very tense state while we're trying to reach some negotiation and some way out of the European Union.
Yeah, I'll give you 5 out of 10 on that one.
Okay. That's not a passing mark.
Okay, so it's a flexible extension. Next one, Ramona.
Ramona. Somebody who wants to remain in the EU and is just really complaining about this whole process. They're moaning about it.
They're moaning. They lost the 2016 referendum.
Million people in the streets of London a couple of weeks ago, they were Ramoners.
They were Ramoners in the eyes of people who just want to leave and have done with it.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Last one, Boris Locke.
Boris Locke. Has to do with Boris Johnson,
yep.
Who was a big pro-Brexit, still is a pro-Brexit guy. I think he wants to be Prime Minister of the UK.
Imagine that Boris Johnson succeeds Theresa May as Prime Minister. He may well want to tear up any agreements that Theresa May has made, first with the European Union, and secondly, with the opposition in Parliament, in order to get some kind of compromise plan through Parliament. So the opposition politicians don't want that deal to get ripped up by a future Conservative government run by Boris Johnson. And so they want to put some kind of parliamentary lock on whatever it is they push out of Parliament right now.
So that would basically lock Boris Johnson out of any future proceedings.
That's what they hope. Of course, you can't stop a future government from passing legislation.
Yeah, and given what we know about Boris Johnson, you can't really stop him from doing anything, can you?
Right.
So, Patrick, do you think any of these words or phrases are going to last?
Boy, it seems unlikely. I mean, Brexit obviously is going to last. I think mainly, though, we just want to forget these words, just like we maybe want to forget this period in British history. We want to forget the words that were used to describe this period, too.
The World's Patrick Cox, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Yeah, feel free to consult our Brexit dictionary anytime you want. It's in our Instagram stories. Just look for PRI The World. We're at the top of the hour, which means it's time for a simple no-nonsense exit. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you on Monday. You have a great weekend, everybody.
PRI, Public Radio International.